In 1975, Evel Knievel did one of his famous motorcycle stunts in London. He wheeled back and forth on giant ramps for quite some time while the announcer waxed poetic.
Prior to the jump, and like any other athlete before any other contest, obviously he was nervous. But just before he came out, made his appearance, did his thing, if you will, with the wheelies back and forth, turning on the crowd. He almost dozed off in a booth. He leaned out the window and looked at a crowd of 80,000 people. He said, "What does a man have to do to get this many people together?" And I looked at him and I said, "Evel, you're doing it."
The crowd was going nuts, just waiting for something to happen. And then finally,
here he goes, and he will go. Oh my God.
This stunt ended in a crash. Emergency crews rushed to Evel Knievel's side. It was a scary moment for everyone. Looking back at these videos now is a reminder that these stunts were actually dangerous. So why did this guy do it, and why did people love to watch? I'm Gina Kaufman, and as a new Evel Knievel Museum opens in Kansas, KCUR's Central Standard looks back at the legacy of this all-American daredevil. Mike Patterson is with us from the Evel Knievel Museum in Topeka. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So what kinds of stuff do you guys have at the Evel Knievel Museum?
Well, everything that was significant, I'd say, to Evel's career and then some is at the museum. I think people are not expecting as much as what we have when they make their visit because it's an incredibly deep collection. So we have everything from his jump bikes, his leathers, helmets, his canes, his x-rays. We have his 63-foot Mack truck semi-trailer and cab inside the museum.
What were those used for?
The cab was what he used for hauling his equipment around the country, and it always was part of his show, part of the grand entrance. It was at every show. So it was also served as his dressing room, and it was the first semi really in history to be used that way. Nobody had done that. Now it's very common with race teams and such, but Evel's truck was significant in the trucking industry for that, and it's amazing to have the huge piece inside the museum.
You talk about it was his dressing room, and that brings up for me the question of exactly how would you label Evel Knievel? I mean, we heard the announcer in that little clip call him an athlete. Is that the title you would give him?
Boy, I don't know if you could give him one title. He was, you know, so many things. He was an athlete for sure. He was an American hero. He was a daredevil.
Why was he a hero?
Well, I think people saw him as a hero because of the stunts that he attempted, and he didn't make every one of them, obviously. You know, we listened to the Wembley Stadium jump there, and that was actually a really bad one. But the thing about what made Evel a hero to people was after he crashed, and it was really, really bad, and he broke his pelvis, he broke his back, arm, had a concussion, he stood back up and had them help him walk to the top of the ramp to thank the crowd for coming that day. And that's what he did every time that he jumped or that he crashed, whether he made it or not. And I think what people saw in him was, even though he's knocked down, he would get back up and then he would come back again. You know, everybody thought it was his last jump each time. And there were many times where he didn't think he could make it, but he had given his word that he was going to make the jump. And he went anyway. So I think people respected it, and it was a lot of the human spirit to get knocked down but get back up, and he did it in front of a worldwide audience, and I think that's what made him a hero.
What do you know about his life that maybe explains why he did any of this at all?
Well, he came from Butte, Montana, and he had a rough childhood. He grew up with his grandparents. Kind of a wild kid, got in a lot of trouble, ended up in jail for just, you know, little things around Butte, and was well known to the police. Uh, he He ended up getting married and had some children, and he needed to provide for them. I mean, that's really what it boiled down to. He tried some different things, and he was an insurance salesman for a while. He was
a little safer, perhaps.
A little safer, yeah. And he broke some records with that, but he was a guide for hunting. He did a lot of different things, but he ended up back on his motorcycle, which he had been riding through the streets, and that's why he got in a lot of trouble in Butte, and ended up doing some stunt shows, and it went from there and started making some money and made a career out of it, and just kind of had to keep outdoing himself as he went along.
You have your own relationship with motorcycles. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yeah, my family is has owned the historic Harley-Davidson in Topeka, Kansas for 68 years. My grandfather purchased it in 1949, so I've grown up in the motorcycle world, and Evel Knievel rode Harley-Davidsons, so that was part of my childhood in the 70s was seeing Evel, and everybody knew about him, I think, that was a kid and or even an adult in that era, but it was especially significant to me because of my tie with motorcycles. And I actually got to see him jump when I was 4 years old at the Hutchinson State Fair or the Kansas State Fair in Hutchinson, Kansas. So I remember it vividly. It left
at
an
four.
Impression on me.
You were
yeah,
four and four. You remember it vividly.
It's kind of, I think, the only thing I remember from 4 years old. But, it was a huge deal. And, it's pretty crazy to me and surreal that the motorcycle he jumped that day is sitting in the museum that's connected to our dealership now. And I can look at it, but I never would have guessed that thing would have ended up in the museum.
What was the jump that he did at the state fair in Kansas?
He jumped Mack trucks that day, and there had been motorcycle races going on previously, and I just remember that it took a long time. There was a lot of pomp and circumstances and a lot of drama, and the crowd stuck around, and it was sold out, and by the time he jumped, it was kind of anticlimactic because it happened so fast, but it was really the build-up with a lot of his jumps, the anticipation, which was the exciting part.
Yeah, I've wondered about that.
Better. Yeah.
Because it seems like from the videos I've watched, him sort of wheeling back and forth and revving his motor and stuff like that took a lot longer than jumping took.
The jumping was really, like I said, it's kind of anticlimactic, but it was, when he would take a run at it, and he was doing his speed runs, and he would look like he's going to jump, and then he would swerve and go by the ramp. Everybody was always on the edge of their seat each time, and it just created – he was a master at working the crowd, and that's why he became so successful too. He just really knew what sparked people and what made people nervous, and he mastered that. And people, not only came to the events he was at when he was on Wilder Sports, they broke records with the viewership on the ABC Wilder Sports telecast.
You said something that intrigues me. You said he knew what would make people nervous. Do you think, I had never really thought about that before, but that's part of what he's doing. He's maybe like a visual storyteller who gets his suspense from making people nervous.
Unquestionably. I think people, when they watch him, they put themselves in his shoes and think how nervous they would be. And Evel was nervous too. I mean, he always kind of claimed that, he was Evel Knievel and he was fearless. But, as we've delved into his life and all of the archive paperwork and the memoirs that we have in the museum from him, we know that he wasn't fearless. He was just like everybody else, but he was getting up there and doing it. And he jumped 168 times and he crashed 19. And people were like, "Oh, that's a pretty good percentage," but every one of those 19 crashes hurt. And the crashes, ironically, are what made him famous, because if he would have made them all, people wouldn't have been nervous. And that's what the trick was.
What do you think is his legacy? I mean, in the world of entertainment, I've wondered if this is the precursor to reality TV, and that someone's doing something insane and potentially dangerous, and we're all just sitting on our couches totally mesmerized. I mean, he had a live crowd, but part of this was a television event.
No doubt. I think you hit the nail on the head. He was the precursor to reality TV. He was also really the start of extreme sports. There had been people that had done things, you know, there was always stunt shows and everything, but nobody that had taken it to the level of Evel Knievel and had such a worldwide audience. He is credited by many people for creating, like, on ESPN, the X Games, and all that, almost a whole culture and a sport that derived from what he did. He inspired those first people that started doing that, and they would all say that, and they do. I mean, they credit Evel Knievel for that. So I think there still would have been things like that, but, you know, it's a part of our American culture, and it's actually gone worldwide now, that really you can take back to one guy that pushed the limits and didn't really know exactly what he was doing. He wasn't the techniques and the skills that it takes now. Evel really didn't have those because he was the first guy. He had to be a groundbreaker. And again, that's just what made him famous and why people watched, because it wasn't, you just never knew what was going to happen.
Let's talk to KCUR's Frank Morris. He's with us now. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Gina.
What's your interest in the Evel Knievel story?
Oh, you know, I mean, like Mike, I you know, kind of grew up thinking Evel Knievel was pretty dang awesome, and I was interested in motorcycles and, you know, doing little stunts on my bike and that kind of thing. And so, you know, when they said they were going to open the museum about a year ago, they started talking about this, or I saw it in the paper. I pitched it to NPR thinking, well, you know, maybe they'll be interested, maybe they won't. But guess what? Like, you know, of the two editors I work with most at NPR, these are NPR editors, they both love Evel Knievel. They both, like, really, you know, want to hear more about Evel Knievel. So it was easy. It was an easy, easy pitch.
You sound maybe kind of surprised.
I was a little, you know, I mean, you know, talking about, you know, guys who, you know, are steeped in NPR. There's NPR as NPR gets, and they were big, big Evel Knievel fans, which shows you that, you know, there is something almost sort of viscerally appealing about this guy who just, you know, went for it. And he was, you know, he was like not exactly the first of his kind. You know, there were other stunt drivers and that sort of thing. This Joey Chitwood guy who inspired Evel Knievel from Topeka, but there, you know, like the chutzpah, that Evel Knievel showed, not, I mean, at the end of the ramp for sure, but also just in the way he, like, kind of kicked in the door and got to where he was, really just based on his own force of nature, that's something that is pretty appealing. And you know, when...
Wait, what do you mean by that, though, when he kicked in the door and got where he was?
Well, so there's this famous story, and Mike could probably tell it better than me, but, you know... where Evel Knievel, he's you know, he does a jump on TV, and he's kind of starting to get set, but he you know, he wants to take it to the next level, and he decides he's going to jump these fountains, these long row of fountains in front of Caesar's Palace, which was a new, you know, casino at the time in Las Vegas, probably a sort of a, you know, marquee place. And he just decided he was going to do it, and then, but he couldn't get the guy Jay Serrano, the guy who ran Caesar's Palace, to even talk to him. So he started, he called all these reporters, and he told them, you know, hey, you know, coming up, Evel Knievel, this amazing daredevil, is going to jump the fountains at Caesar's Palace. He's first told, he called a bunch of reporters and told them that. And then he starts calling Jay Serrano. using, maybe disguising his voice a little bit, saying, "Hey, I need to talk to Mr. Sorrent. This is, Sam Zeff from Sports Illustrated. And what's this Ivel Knievel or whatever his name is going to, this amazing guy is going to do this crazy stunt in front of your place." And Jay Serrano was like, "I don't know what you're talking about." And then he would call back a few days later. "This is, Dan Margulies from Wide World of Sports. And I apparently this awful Knievel, I don't know what his name is. He's going to jump, And by the time Ivel Knievel called as Ivel Knievel again, this Jay Serrano goes like, "Hey, I got to talk to you. I guess we're doing some kind of deal." And he invited him in. And apparently, the guy running Caesar's Palace was a lot like Ivel Knievel in that he was, he liked his drink and he liked his women and but he was kind of a big character that liked to do things. And so they hit it off. And so they worked this deal, but then Ivel Knievel never jumped that far and he didn't know how to do it, and he got himself into this situation where he's got to do it. But this was a completely, he talked everybody
and
into
it is
doing
insane.
And then he's faced with having to do it.
It is also an insane idea. We take it maybe for granted now as a part of our cultural history that there's this guy who, it's sort of a bizarre idea, likes to take a motorcycle and just go over something that he should not be able to clear.
Yeah, you know what, too? Also, I learned this at the museum. I didn't know this, but none of Ivel Knievel's bikes have speedometers on them, And think about that. In an age where we're, calculating everything out, if you're running in a race, well, what's your, mile per mile time, all that stuff. He didn't have any of that. He would just eyeball it, take a few passes. He had a buddy or a mechanic who's kind of like stand there and go, "I think you're going too slow." And they would just kind of, "I've done this before. This is a little longer. Go a little whatever." And they would just kind of like do it. Like he said, by the seat of his pants. It's crazy. It's insane. It really is. It's no small thing what Ivel Knievel did.
The way he worked the media and used the media to get this opportunity, does that interest you in any special way as a journalist?
I love that part, for instance, I did this, it was kind of a low point in his career, actually. It was supposed to be the high point where he jumps the Snake River Canyon, And so at first he had this kind of like goofy looking chitty chitty bang bang kind of motor with little wings and these rockets, and he was theoretically going to jump the Grand Canyon with that, and the Interior Department wouldn't let him do that. And so he got together with a team, and Mike, jump in if I get this wrong, but I mean he had a team of actual engineers, like rocket guys, built him some they weren't even really motorcycles, but they're like little rockets on wheels to shoot up over the Grand Canyon. It's going to be his Grand Canyon jump. Well, they built three of them. They intentionally dumped the first one into the canyon just to build excitement. Like, "Oh, it didn't work. Oh, I don't know." you know what I mean?
We're raising the stakes.
Yeah. But it's just kind of like, what Mike was saying. I mean, he was good at making people nervous and getting people interested. So, yeah, I mean, that also is fascinating.
Mike, is there something you want to add about that story and what it means to you?
Well, a really cool part of that story is that we have a sky cycle in the museum, one of his actual sky cycles, and it's sitting on a 20-foot section of the actual ramp from the Snake River jump with the actual dirt from the jump site beneath it. It's one of our coolest artifacts that we have, and I think that something that other people didn't know, too, is the engineers that he worked with, they built this rocket, and it was not powered by jet fuels or rocket engines. It was a steam-powered sky cycle, which meant there was just a canister in there that they put water in and heated it up to 456 degrees and then basically pulled the plug, and that's where the thrust came from. So it was just basically a rocket burning water.
Frank, do these things that are on display, I mean, you talked about the that they don't, the bikes don't have speedometers. Do they otherwise seem kind of janky by today's standards? I mean, especially to be doing something like attempting to clear a canyon.
Oh yeah, totally.
A grand one.
I mean, you know, and you know, it's you know, I mean, Mike's a Harley dealer, and Evil was sponsored by Harley for, you know, like, you know, the apex of his career. But you know, there's a little Honda. He started out. He was Evel Knievel was selling Hondas when he started doing tricks, and so there's a little, you know, Honda. There's the Triumph. There's this American Eagle, weird, you know, Italian bike that probably was kind of a crummy motorcycle that Evel Knievel missed a bunch of jumps on, you know, because it was too heavy and sort of underpowered, you know. But yeah, you know, they make motorcycles now like everything else, you know. They make them specifically for A, motocross, and B, you know, jumping, you know, stuff. So with really beefy suspension, and the kind of motorcycles Evel Knievel was jumping on were just like flat track dirt race bikes. You know, they were race bikes. You could just go down to the Harley dealer and buy a race bike. He would kind of beef up the handlebars and the foot pegs because those things would collapse on impact. But other than that, you know, he didn't have a whole bunch of suspension. These bikes are heavy, you know. I mean, it's nuts. And again, he was doing it. You know, you can go into the museum and science it out a little bit. Well, I need to be going faster, you know. And there's a little exhibit where, oh, you missed, you know, here's how fast you need to be going to jump this space. He didn't do any of that stuff. He just sort of like, you know, eyeballed it and went for it.
As someone who rides a motorcycle, is there something that you think you might be able to help us appreciate that those of us non-adrenaline junkie, non-motorcycle riding people might not just get intuitively?
About Evel Knievel?
Yeah. Or do you think we all get it intuitively? Like, this is just a daredevil feat?
No, I don't think that everybody gets it intuitively, honestly. I mean, you know, because a lot of people really bend over backwards, or, you know, really are risk averse, you know, and that's rational, you know. But if you kind of open up this other window, which is, you know, hey, I really feel alive right now, you know, then if you're one of those people, you know, you kind of like not necessarily taking risk, but kind of, you know, being on the edge in some where, you know, you could make a mistake and it would be costly. So you're much more aware and alert.
It helps you kind of focus and get attuned.
Right. Maybe. So, I mean, there's that. I mean, but, you know, just riding a motorcycle down to the grocery store and Evel Knievel is so many factors of, you know, degree different. But I think, and Mike, you know, been on bikes all his life and sells to people. I mean, there is something kind of gleeful. You know, as people always say, you see a lot of grinning motorcycle riders. And I think, you know, it's a good feeling. It's just an invigorating feeling.
You know, we've talked about how he might have had an impact on American culture or on entertainment television. But do we look at our landscape differently because of him?
Landscape, like the West?
Yeah, just the way that he, I mean, when you think about his stunts, he looked at a Grand Canyon and he didn't think of it as something to look at. He thought of it as something to conquer.
Something iconic that he can be a part of. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I would, you know, venture that. I mean, I think that Evel Knievel, though, did definitely have a big impact on guys like me. You know, my 50s, you know, little kid who, you know, grew up with this guy who was dressed like a superhero, doing this crazy stuff that nobody'd ever done before. And he was just so dang tough. And, you know, I mean, so he definitely had an impact on impressionable kids of my generation.
We've heard him describe. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
What I was going to say was, Evel was real. He was a real guy, and he was the first actual person to be characterized in a comic book. You know, before that, it was Batman, Superman, Captain America. They were all, you know, not real. Evel was real, and he had his own comic book. He was the first to have his own action figure. You know, there was G.I. Joe, but Evel was real, and I think that's what he was a real-life hero for a lot of young boys and girls.
Mike Patterson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Frank, thank you.
Oh, you bet.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll shift from gravity-defying stunts to stereotype-defying leaps in a conversation with Misty Copeland. Stay tuned. Even if you aren't a ballet aficionado, there's a good chance you've heard of Misty Copeland, a documentary about her journey as the first African-American principal dancer in the American Ballet Theater came out in 2015. It drew a lot of attention to race in the world of dance. It also turned Misty Copeland into a household name. What you might not know is that she was born in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and it's an honor to be speaking with Misty Copeland as she returns to her hometown. Hi, Misty.
Hi.
So you are here with a new book, and we're going to get to that, but I want to start with Kansas City because we're here.
Okay.
Your memoir, A Life in Motion, begins with a ride away from Kansas City on a Greyhound bus.
Right. Yes. You know, it's funny. I don't have a lot of memory of Kansas City, but I have family still there, and I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, but moved to California, to Southern California, when I was 2 years old. But I feel like I have these kind of not my own memories, but memories of my mother's, just from hearing so many stories about her growing up and being, you know, a Kansas City Chiefs cheerleader, and she was, you know, we were diehard Kansas City Chiefs fans, even as children, not knowing what we were really rooting for.
It seems like it also has kind of, like, leaving here was the beginning of, I don't know, a certain kind of childhood experience that...
Right.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I was one of four children when my mother left Kansas City and moved to California. And that kind of was the beginning of what became really familiar to me, which was moving a lot and not really having stability in terms of where I was and schools and you know, even a place to live. So leaving Kansas, you know, really just kind of began this rocky childhood for me and my siblings. We eventually became six kids, and it wasn't until I was 13 years old that I stumbled into a ballet class, which forever changed my life. But you know, all of it kind of just led me to this path. You know, if I weren't in a situation of not having a stable home and my mother working many jobs, I wouldn't have been attending the Boys and Girls Club of San Pedro, California, you know, the community center where I found ballet. So, you know, I'm so thankful and grateful for my path, as hard as it was for all of us kids and my mother as well, raising us pretty much on our own. I wouldn't be who I am and where I am if I didn't have that path and gotten on that Greyhound bus leaving Kansas City at 2 years old.
Yeah, I mean, 2 years old is so young. And then you talk about finding dance at 13. Do you think that that was the next, like, home you had? Or is that an exaggeration?
Absolutely. Not an exaggeration at all. I mean, it absolutely became that to me. And probably, you know, the first conscious home that I can remember, you know, because I was so young when I left Kansas. But the stage and the ballet studio became the only real constant in my life. And the one place that, you know, there wasn't chaos. There weren't, you know, sports games on the TV and all of us screaming in one room, all of us kids, you know, just existing in, you know, small spaces and not always having our own space and own room. Ballet was just the sanctuary and became just this really stable atmosphere for me and the first in my life.
Other than, like, that psychological aspect of it, what do you think it was that made you fall in love with ballet? Can you put your finger on it?
It was a combination of things. I think when I first, you know, being introduced to movement through my mother from a young age and having music constantly, you know, on around the house, I felt a very organic connection to creating with my body. So that was kind of the first step to leading me towards dance. But it was probably having that escape and that place that was so far from what I knew as familiar in my life. The studio was the first place that was just like this serene, calm place where I could be free and have a voice and create and not feel judged or have to speak in order to communicate. And it's really interesting that I didn't feel judged, because when you're in a ballet class, I mean, you're staring in a mirror, judging yourself, and you're getting so much criticism from, you know, the teacher, the ballet mistress. So it's very interesting that I had that response to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me too. I mean, they say that you were a true prodigy. Did you feel that?
I knew that it was easier for me. It wasn't, but the thing is, I don't think I'd ever experienced being on a team, being a part of, you know, a sport in any way. And school was all I knew, which was a struggle for me. I never felt comfortable in school. I never felt confident. I always felt like I was just trying to fit in and not be seen. But in ballet, I was okay with working really hard, and I loved the journey of learning something new every single day. There was just something that felt so natural for me. And like my body just kind of fit into this world, and I just adapted really easily.
You say many times as a refrain in your memoir, this is for the little brown girls. Can you explain what that means to you?
Yeah. You know, it's something that's kind of, become more conscious, for me, the older that I got in my professional career. You know, coming from a biracial family, you know, being African American was not always something that I was, you know, thinking about. My mother made it very clear that, you know, I'm of Italian, German, and African American descent. But most likely, the way that we look and living in America, we're going to be seen as Black African Americans. So that was something that I was very aware of, but it wasn't until I was in the ballet studio and a professional that I really realized the lack of diversity in the classical ballet world. And growing up, you know, having the privilege of growing up in a really diverse community in Southern California, that wasn't something that ever crossed my mind. You know, there was just every hue and every nationality, you know, where I grew up. And so it wasn't until I was, you know, a professional and I realized, you know, why am I doing this? Do I really belong here? Will I ever truly succeed beyond, you know, being in American Ballet Theater and being in the Court of Ballet is a huge accomplishment.
But yeah, that's thought, like basically the center of gravity for the ballet world.
It absolutely is. And to be, you know, the only African-American woman in the company for 10 years, I started to kind of question my purpose and whether or not I was really being accepted by, you know, audience members, because I heard a lot of chatter and, you know, to my face also, you
what
know,
that kind I, of chatter,
just that, you know, it's hard when the ballet world is so defined by uniformity, especially in the corps de ballet, which is, you know, the group of dancers that, surround the leading dancers that kind of create the atmosphere and they want everyone to kind of blend in together. And I did not fit in terms of, you know, my skin color. So, you know, it wasn't until I really accepted, recognized, acknowledged that, and then owned it, that I understood the bigger impact that I could have on the world and on the ballet world. You know, it wasn't just about me being a ballet dancer, but it was like, this is a huge deal for our society, for the African American community to be able to see someone who looks like them and feel that they can be a part of this world that they haven't always been accepted in. So I felt like I got to a point where every opportunity that I had to go out there and be on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House and represent brown dancers, it was like, this is for the little brown girls. I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for the next generation. I'm doing this for those African-American dancers that were never given the opportunities that I have. And so I feel like that was kind of this fuel that got me to where I am today.
But when you joined the American Ballet Theater and there weren't other dancers who looked like you, and there hadn't been someone who looked like you who had risen all the way to the top as a principal mm-hmm. dancer in an entire 75-year history, mm-hmm. did that affect how you saw your future, how you saw your own potential as you tried to launch your career?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't initially because, I mean, I had only trained for 4 years, and that's very rare before I became a professional. So
very rare.
I feel like, yeah, so I feel like I was so consumed with so many other things that it took me a couple of years before I kind of like lifted my head up and was like, oh my gosh, this is an issue, you know, that I'm the only one here. And it definitely, I think, hurt me. The first, you know, maybe 5 years I was in the company, I had so much self-doubt and, you know, I lost this very easy, natural confidence that I always had, you know, while I was on stage. And I think had I early on had more support and the support I try and give, you know, other dancers of color, maybe I would have had a quicker journey, or it just wouldn't have been so hard. And that's what I want for the next generation. I want this, you know, I think the discussion will always have to be had about the lack of diversity, but I want them to see a path and to be able to follow somewhat, you know, so many dancers throughout the history of ballet, they have a path set out for them, you know, and African-American dancers just haven't had that in classical ballet.
You know, it's super interesting to me that you brought up uniformity in the dance world. Your new book about sort of how to achieve this ballerina's body, the body is really like the thing that has to be uniform, and skin color can be a part of that. But a lot of other things can be a part of that, too. I'm interested in what a ballerina's body means to you.
Yeah. So I think unless you read the book, it's hard to understand where I'm coming from in terms of choosing those words for the title. My acceptance and understanding of the ballet body has evolved so much throughout my professional career. And I think that the ballerina's body is constantly evolving from, you know, decade to decade. And, you know, you look back on, you know, dancers and Degas paintings and, you know, these dancers in the 1920s and 30s, and they had very feminine and soft bodies and they weren't as muscular and not at all as thin as people associate, you know, the ballerina body to be, which changed, you know, in the early 60s and throughout the 70s and 80s. And it, once again, it's evolved. We're much more athletic than they once were. So for me, I've learned that everyone's version of a ballerina body is going to be different. Like, we weren't all born with coming from the same parents. We don't all have the same genes and genetics. So we're going to look different and we're going to have a different response to how our body builds muscle and, you know, how our muscles respond to doing the classical technique. So to me, having a ballerina body is having a strong and healthy version of your own ideal of what that means. So everyone's healthy body is going to look different.
When I was a younger kid, I was fairly serious about ballet, and there were auditions for the different, you know, big ballet schools and their summer programs, and they would come through town, and all the little girls would have numbers on the fronts of their bodies, and some of these schools would take photographs of you, like, from the neck down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the idea that, you know, that's part of the evaluation is just your faceless body and what kind of, like, quote unquote,
right,
material this was. Yeah. And
right,
on the one hand, I do get it. Like, there is a certain body type that when it extends a leg to the fullest, it's going to look longer mm-hmm. and more dramatic on one body type
right.
than another.
Right.
That kind of thing. I do get it, but I'm curious about your journey with all of that stuff.
Yeah. So I understand that that's just been how the ballet world has worked from the beginning. You know, that you have to have certain, you know, proportions in order for your lines and your body to read a certain way when you're on a grand stage. My belief is that you can shape your body to be whatever you want it to be. I think the knowledge that we have about cross training and eating right, Pilates and gyrotonics and floor bar, all of these things, there are so many extremely successful, well-known dancers that probably if you measured their proportions don't fit the mold of what you're supposed to be. Because when you go on stage and people are moved, it's that thing that you can't touch that a performer has that makes you drawn to them. It's not the length of their, you know, shin bone or the size of their head. It's that something special that performers, you know, special performers have that draw an audience. And to me, that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're doing as dancers and as artists. We're giving people an escape in the theater. And that has nothing to do for me with this cookie cutter body.
Is there a role that you have had that you think brought out that special touch from you in a particular way, like a role that you as a performer just connected with magically?
As a student, I feel like I connected with every role that I did and I felt just magical on stage. But as I got older, you know, again, I had so many obstacles that it took me a while to really own that again. And Firebird was probably the first of many that I really connected with. And I think it was just the timing of it all. It was the timing of, you know, being 29 years old when I was given the opportunity to learn and perform the part of Firebird, and just having this fire in me that like, this is my last shot. Like, I'm old to be a soloist and given an opportunity to be a principal. And, you know, knowing of all the young brown dancers that were looking up to me, like, this is our shot, you know, gave me this added fuel.
No woman of color had played that role before.
Not at American Ballet Theater. The Dance Theater of Harlem, you know, their version of Firebird is actually really famous. And I have this image that's just kind of like embedded in my mind of being in New York City at 16 years old and seeing these Firebird posters of Dance Theater of Harlem with these black women doing the role. So in my eyes, it was like, yeah, the Firebird is a brown woman. That's like what I knew. But no, a black woman has not done most roles that I've done to this point as a principal dancer at American Ballet Theater.
The lead role in Firebird, it's very, for people who haven't seen it, the movements are, I would describe, just sort of jerky. Like, there's not the fluidity that people might associate with ballet.
Right. It's not at all Odette Odile in Swan Lake. She is a creature that has been captured. So every time you see her dancing, it's like she's trying frantically to get away. It's like holding a bird or a bat in your hands. And it's like the fluttering of their wings, like them trying to escape is I think the best way I can describe the movement of, you know, typically the choreography for the Firebird, which you know, is different depending on what version you're doing. I was doing choreography by Alexei Rotmansky, but you listen to the Stravinsky music and it's not fluid sounding. So I think you can imagine by listening to the music how the movement would be.
When was the last time you came back to Kansas City? I mean, you moved away at two, pretty young.
At two.
When did you come back?
Gosh, it was the year that 9/11 happened in New York City. My birthday is September 10th, and American Ballet Theater came to Kansas City, and we were performing, and we arrived the evening of the 10th, and I saw family that I'd never met before, and I spent my birthday with them. And then the morning of the 11th, we woke up, and 9/11 had happened in New York City. And so that's kind of my last memory of Kansas City. It was something that I will never forget. And we still performed that night, even though, you know, I think that we just wanted to give people an opportunity to still have that escape and see something beautiful, even the evening of 9/11.
What were you performing that night?
There was a ballet called Black Tuesday.
Whoa.
And yeah, I know. So ironic, and interesting, but, it's a more, modern, I believe it's a Paul Taylor piece. Yeah, it was difficult for a lot of the dancers, but it also was like a way of us just to like come together and, you know, unite in that way and kind of support each other and use the arts to bring people together, which is what it does.
Misty Copeland, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we're going to be back with a run to the drive-thru, actually. That story comes from a show on comfort food.
I would like a water, a limeade, a grilled cheese, and an order of fries.
And your grilled cheese on white bread or rye?
On white. I'm sitting in the same booth at the Winsteads on the Plaza that my friends and I used to spend hours and hours at back when I was in high school. We used to drink endless cups of coffee, nibble on French fries. I imagine we probably drove the waitstaff crazy. It's a booth that's in the section way in the back by the old lunch counter. That would have been more than 15 years ago. Damn. But being from Kansas City, that, of course, is not even my first or best Winsteads memory. I remember my grandparents bringing me and my sisters here when we were kids, normally after a movie or something. On special occasions, and if we were well-behaved, sometimes they'd let us order a skyscraper. It's an ice cream float served out of a flower vase that, according to the menu, is enough for 2, 3, or 4 people. But I never remember being able to finish one. But even that is not my favorite or most nostalgic thing about this place. It's the ice. No matter the occasion or what I ordered, it is always the same. It's my favorite type of ice. Not too crunchy, not too sloshy, and it just makes their water and limeades just so good. Mm. If you grew up in Kansas City, maybe you feel what I'm talking about. Or maybe you have your own memories or nostalgia for a different place altogether.
I think comfort food is tied in with our memories and the people that we share the food with. We've been here 76 years, so people have tons and tons of memories here.
Kathy Fern has been the general manager for Winsteads on the Plaza for over 30 years. She says, yes, there are the limeades, shakes, and steak burgers, but mostly nostalgia is the driving force behind their business.
It's crazy. I worked 12 and a half hours yesterday. It has to be your passion to work down here, because whenever there's a holiday is when families get together, and so families want to recreate those memories at Winsteads, so that's when we're really busy.
There are 7 Winsteads locations throughout the metro, all with that classic 50s style. But the one on the Plaza was the first. It opened in 1940 by the Winstead sisters, Nellie and Catherine Winstead. It started off as a diner selling root beer and hamburgers, and then later they introduced shakes and fries. It's a history that server Judy Eddingfield knows a lot about.
The dining room only used to be 2 counters and 10 booths in the original building, and most of the business was on the outside.
Judy started working here in 1965 as a car hop, bringing food to people in their cars back when Winsteads was still a drive-in. Her mother had started working here when she was 3 years old, and then she started working at the restaurant with her mother as a teenager. And yes, she still works here today. That's 51 years of waiting tables here.
Oh, this place is my second family, really. You know, I mean, I've gone through a lot of people over the years, over the 51 years, but it's still like home.
Judy says it's been fun to be a part of the Winsteads tradition for older and younger patrons that come in. And about 5 years ago, the waitstaff started a new tradition where they sing a song whenever a skyscraper is ordered. And another newer Winsteads tradition that also started about 5 years ago was the introduction of the lone tater tot in an order of French fries.
Thank you.
Enjoy it.
There it is. Lone Tot.
Manager Kathy Fern says it's something that the restaurant did back when they first put tater tots on the menu. And at first, it started only as a promotional thing, you know, to get people thinking about tots. But it stuck.
We started noticing that people were really excited when they got that extra tater tot. We even saw messages on social media and reviews about this particular restaurant about that they were so excited they got this extra tater tot and thinking it might have been a mistake and it was a bonus. And so we've just continued that tradition.
And in all fairness, it doesn't happen every single time, but it's something that they strive to do most times. So as silly as it can seem to feel special about getting the lone tot in the midst of fries, it is true that when you get one, like I did, it makes you feel good.
That was KCUR's Suzanne Hogan with a story from the very end of last year. And that's all for today's show. To listen back to this encore presentation or any other show on KCUR's Central Standard, you can visit us at kcur.org/centralstandard and follow us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Jen Chen, and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap.